It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
It's the Media Buzz Meter with Howard Kurtz.
Big tech wants to control your life, and I have the evidence. I'm really ticked off about this. Not exactly shocking that big technology companies, Silicon Valley giants, want to tell you what to think, what to do. But I use Google's Gmail. And the other day, this box pops up, you know, one of these pop-ups where you have to say yes or no. And it says, you know, two-step verification is the greatest thing of all time. And here's your choice. We want you to use it. Choice number one, already in. I'm using it. The other box says, count me in. So the choices are yes and yes. And I wasn't prepared to say yes, particularly on a home computer that nobody else uses. But there's no way to exit out. So it's just up there for days and it's blocking my view of some of the headers and some of the email. And I'm like, this is ridiculous. You know, it's supposed to be here's the options. And the options are you do what we say or go away. Incredible. Hey, I hope you have a good weekend coming up. Hope you'll catch Media Buzz Sunday morning, 11 Eastern. Now, I basically know next to nothing about NFTs, non-fungible tokens, but I do know they're very popular. I haven't spent a lot of time trying to figure out why they're so valuable, if they are, if it's just another one of these bubble markets going to burst like crypto. But here's one about Madonna, and yeah, it's got sex in it, so that's why I'm discussing it with you. All right, so I don't know where I picked this up from, but Madonna, who's now 63, she has created this NFT, and it's very not safe for work. So in this NFT, and it sounds very salacious, she's fully nude, and she's giving birth to butterflies, insects, and trees coming out of her vagina. Now, before you all rush to click on it, you don't really see a picture of Madonna. You see a kind of a... I don't know exactly what to call it. It's not quite a sketch. It's a representation of Madonna, almost cartoon-like. And again, coming out of that area are animated, you know, trees and so forth. And what Madonna says is, I'm doing what women have been doing since the beginning of time, which is giving birth. But on a more existential level, I'm giving birth to art and creativity, and we would be lost without both. I guess it's clever. I'm sure a lot of people have already clicked on it. She's given any proceeds to charity. So Madonna, you know, trying to create a new trend or stay ahead of the curve or whatever. Ralph Nader was once a tremendous consumer advocate. You know, he exposed an unsafe car and he became this nationally known consumer fighter. And this is before, you know, he decided it was his mission in life to run for president every 4 years. And a lot of people, Democrats, still blame him for running in 1980 and siphoning away, as a Green Party guy, votes from Al Gore that they think enabled George W. Bush to win the election. Who knows what would have happened if Nader hadn't run. But Nader is now 88. And he has a complaint about the New York Times. Now, you would think that a guy who, you know, has taken on multinational corporations and so forth would have something substantive to say. Well, here's his complaint. The New York Times sports page thinks its readers are more interested by far in Real Madrid, that's the European soccer team, than in real Yankees in New York City. Yankees and Mets baseball games are almost invisible. Not even the scores are printed in the Times Suburban Sports Edition anymore. Go figure. Does he sound a little cranky? Look, first of all, the Times is a national newspaper, but it does have a metro edition, and it does cover the hometown teams. Maybe that doesn't make it into print. Perhaps Mr. Nader is familiar with this thing called the internet. Times has a website. I do believe they cover every game of the Yankees and Mets. There's some pretty good sports writers there. But look, he's weighed in. I guess he understands the internet because this is a tweet. So Ralph Nader's on Twitter. I hadn't realized that. Okay. And finally, North Korea has reported its first case of COVID-19. That's remarkable. How did North Korea escape this worldwide pandemic? Well, the South Korean news agency says that actually there are over 18,000 patients in North Korea suffering from coronavirus. Now, that's what you can do when you're a totalitarian country that controls the media. You say, no problem, no problem, no. Oh, we have one case. All right. Lots of cover here, beginning with number one. And there's lots of news on the Elon Musk front, so your daily Elon episode. First, let me start with the thing that I thought was going to be the big Elon news of the day. But the thing is, if you don't check back, it's like Trump. If you don't check back every 2 hours, you miss a whole bunch of stuff. So Elon Musk, you know, who created these great ways by saying he wants to put Donald Trump back on Twitter, even though Trump says he doesn't want to come, tweeted this. Even though I think a less divisive candidate would be better in 2024, I still think Trump should be restored to Twitter. So he's saying, hey, folks, you all think that I've gone sort of totally right wing, that I'm doing this because I love Trump. I don't love Trump that much. I don't think he should be the Republican nominee, but I do think the permanent ban is absurd. And then in order to be, I don't know, fair and balanced, he follows that up with a second tweet saying Biden's mistake is that he thinks he was elected to transform the country, but actually everyone just wanted less drama. So takes a little shot at Trump, takes a little shot at the current president of the United States. And that's interesting. He also said that I think Twitter should authenticate all real users and prioritize those replies above unauthenticated users. I agree with that. I don't understand why all these people who, you know, have these phony made-up names should be treated equally. I'm not saying they should be banned, but more priority for people who use their real names and have been authenticated. Yeah, I think so. Okay, but the big now front page news, or digitally speaking front page news, is that maybe the deal's not going to go through. Elon Musk announcing rather dramatically, this is shortly before I sat down at the mic here, that his deal to buy Twitter is temporarily on hold after the social network reported that fake accounts, spam accounts, comprise less than 5% of the 226 million daily active users on the site. Now remember, Elon Musk is going to spend $44 billion on this. And he's saying Twitter deal temporarily on hold, pending details supporting calculation that spam slash fake accounts do indeed represent less than 5% of users. Now, as a result of just that tweet, the stock price of Twitter has plummeted 19%. I guess that's in pre-market trading. Tesla, which has taken a beating lately and whose stock value Musk needs in order to complete this purchase, and that's another thing that's kind of overshadowing this deal, up 5%. So Twitter did this filing and it says, look, Musk has a point. It notes that calculations about the number of spam estimates are an estimate. The real number could be higher than we have estimated. And in the past, well, just a few weeks ago, Twitter said it had overcounted its daily users for 3 straight years. So naturally, this is causing a complete and total freakout in the business world, in the social media world. I think Musk maybe didn't intend it to be quite as dramatic, although he had to know what he was doing, because this one follow-up tweet, which I literally just saw, saying, still committed to the acquisition. So what's going on here? What's going on is that this may just be a negotiating tactic. If it turns out that Musk assumed that there were a certain percentage of bot accounts and fake and spam accounts, and that percentage is actually much higher, then Twitter's less viable to him. He's already betting that he can increase users by tripling the number of users. So it could be a negotiating tactic. It could be that suddenly he has real doubts about this because he doesn't trust Twitter's numbers. Or it could be that given the Tesla stock issue that I mentioned and how much of his personal fortune Elon Musk will be putting at risk, that he's looking for a way to back out. What a anticlimax that would be. And this is going to provide the cover. I don't know which of those is the answer. I know Musk tweets a lot of things. I know that there's a lot of money at stake. My gut tells me he still wants to do this, and he's trying to force Twitter to make sure, you know, I mean, this is due diligence. You know, you don't do a deal of this magnitude or any magnitude, really, without making sure the numbers are real. He doesn't want to buy Twitter and turn, let's say it turns out that 10%, let's say it turns out that 20% of the accounts aren't real. Well, that's a very, you know, then it's not worth as much, clearly. So I don't know exactly where they stand, but still committed to the acquisition suggests to me that he still wants to do it. Meanwhile, two top Twitter executives were fired by this current CEO. Undoubtedly, the sort of clear the decks for Musk's expected takeover. And they're probably waking up today saying, oh, if only we had hung on, maybe he's going to back out. So the CEO, Parag Agrawal, has fired these two top guys. One of them, while he was on paternity leave, and he tweeted that, you know, he wasn't his decision and he's being forced to leave. The other guy also said he was forced to leave and then tweeted the and then deleted the tweet. Agrawal says it's important to have the right leaders at the right time. And this is in an internal memo. He talks about they didn't hit their targets for what they expected to do even during the pandemic. In order to manage responsibly the organization, we need to continue to be intentional about our teams, hiring, and costs. He's portraying it as a cost-cutting move. Sounds to me like this wouldn't have happened had it not been for the expected Musk takeover. Hey, let's pause right there. The Buzz Meter continues right after this.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcasts.com.
All right, story number two. This is just surreal for me to read this. I mean, it's not that anybody would really be shocked at the details, but the January 6th committee in the House, controlled by Democrats, has now moved to subpoena five Republican members of Congress, including the House Minority Leader, Kevin McCarthy, who also happens to be the likely next speaker. Now, it's almost mind-boggling. I mean, they got to work with this guy every day and, you know, try to move legislation or block legislation or whatever. And McCarthy has always, you know, denounced this as an overly partisan committee after he pulled his members because the Democrats rejected a couple people that he wanted to put on. He says, okay, I'm out of here. And so they ended up with the two leading anti-Trump Republicans in the House, Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney. Anyway, there had been voluntary requests for testimony from Kevin McCarthy, as well as Republican members Mo Brooks, Andy Biggs, Scott Perry, and Jim Jordan. And nothing happened, and now the subpoenas have been issued. Benny Thompson, the chairman, saying, regrettably, the individuals receiving subpoenas today have refused to cooperate, and we're forced to take this step to ensure the committee uncovers the facts. I think the committee probably knows most of what these guys have to say, but you never know. Now, McCarthy, talking briefly to reporters, says my view on the committee has not changed. They're not conducting a legitimate investigation. It seems as though they just want to go after their political opponents. Congressman Perry says this is all for headlines and sensationalization. Andy Biggs on Fox said that the committee doesn't really have the authority to issue subpoenas. He doesn't want to dignify what they're doing. Mo Brooks put out a long statement in which he described the panel as a witch hunt committee and repeated Donald Trump's unproven claims that the 2020 election was stolen. In other words, you're looking into the wrong thing. Now, here's the reality of it. None of this is going to happen. Because the next question is the Democratic-controlled committee and ultimately the Democratic-controlled House going to vote to hold these five members, including Minority Leader McCarthy, in contempt of Congress for their refusal to obey what they would see as a lawful subpoena? And if that happens, would the Justice Department have to take a look at it? But look, this is May. The committee has only until the end of the year. Certainly, if the Republicans take over the House, which is extremely likely, that committee is abolished, boom, on day one, and we probably have the select committee to investigate Hunter Biden. So what these guys are going to do is they're going to run out the clock. They're going to stall. They're going to get their lawyers. They're going to go to court. Whatever they have to do to run out the clock so they'll never have to testify, in my view. There have already been a couple of referrals. Steve Bannon was indicted. That case was pending. But another case involving another subpoena has gone nowhere. And maybe they will hold him in contempt just to, but, you know, that's like civil war in the House. And so you have these two clashing narratives, you know, which is, look, obviously we know a lot from the audio tapes of McCarthy, from the text to Mark Meadows, from McCarthy's own public comments when he kind of turned on Trump briefly before mending fences. that he was very involved with the former president on January 6th and afterwards, and then he went to Mar-a-Lago and they kissed and made up. Same thing for these other guys. I mean, I don't know, they all have a lot of firsthand knowledge. Mo Brooks spoke at the Stop the Steal rally on the morning of January 6th, for example. All right, let me move on to number three. I am just apoplectic and befuddled and pissed off about this baby formula crisis. It's just unflipping believable that we now have a situation where the supply of baby formula is down by something like 43%. All of these moms, those who are not breastfeeding, who rely on formula for their infants, you know, before they can eat, that's it. That's all they can get. And they're all, you know, many of them are panicking, and I don't blame them. I don't have babies anymore, but I did, and we used formula. And, you know, it's, I don't want to get overly dramatic here, but this is a genuine crisis. So the Biden administration yesterday saying, oh, we're working to address the worsening shortage. They're going to speed up the efforts. What I want to know before I even go any further into this, like, how did this sneak up on us? How is it? I'm sure if you go back in the business press, because this all began, we now learn. First of all, did you know? I didn't know that basically four companies control the entire baby formula supply in the United States, and there are laws in place or rules that make it very, very difficult to import baby formula from overseas. Now, how did those laws get in place or those rules? Lobbyists for these big companies. So there was, back in February, a shutdown of one of the major plants by Abbott Nutrition. That's the largest infant formula manufacturer, at a plant in Michigan. There were concerns about bacterial contamination. Four infants became sick. Two of them died. And so Abbott started this voluntary recall. That set in motion a whole bunch of things. And then suddenly, you know, the Biden administration says, well, FDA has a 10-point plan. And all the media are like, wahoo, I didn't know about this. I'm sure if you go back in the business press, there were stories about the Abbott shutdown and so forth. But basically, the national media, and it seems like the Biden administration was taken by surprise. Now, Jen Psaki was out there saying, oh, the president has known about this. He's been briefed. Well, when was he briefed? Well, I'm not going to get into the timing of when he was briefed. And she did say it was before last week. But this has been building for a couple of months now. So what is the administration going to do? President Biden met with retailers and manufacturers, including Walmart and Target and Gerber, to try to increase production. They talked about what the government could do to help stock the shelves, especially in rural areas, according to unnamed senior administration officials talking to the New York Times. The White House announced a bunch of moves, including pushing states to waive packaging regulations, to let them get this stuff out to stores more quickly, instructing the FTC and state officials to crack down on price gouging. I don't think that's the main issue right now, but it's certainly an issue. And the U.S. will start importing more formula somehow from Mexico, Chile, Ireland, and the Netherlands. But nobody's able to say, yeah, and this will be over in X. This is going to go on for months. They can't set a timeline because they don't know, because they're behind the curve. Here's Abigail Spanberger, Democratic congresswoman from Virginia. I'm not satisfied till there's food on the shelves. After she went on TV to complain about this, she got a call from Ron Klain, White House chief of staff. She says they're working on it with a level of urgency. Could they convey it more aggressively? I wish everyone was hair on fire, apoplectic about it. Yeah, I agree with her. Now there's this whole thing about, well, why are they giving any formula to babies at the border? Well, it turns out since 1997, it's been compulsory under the law for border personnel, and I guess anyone who's in custody, to have nutrition, including baby formula. And that policy was followed by the Trump administration, by the Bush administration. So this is nothing new. It's a crisis. It's an absolute crisis. And if I sound a little exercised, I'm probably not anywhere near as exercised as potentially millions of mothers and dads who just want to find some nutrition for their babies. Unfortunately, this reminds me of the Biden administration being very slow on the uptake when it came to the home testing kits. You know, when this is before the Omicron surge, everyone knew a surge was a possibility. They waited and waited and waited. And then people could not get these home tests, could not get them. I remember standing out online in the freezing cold outside my local library where you could get two kits. And that was a complete and total failure. And the Biden and the president and his administration later admitted that. This adds to the feeling that things are out of control, that this is not a competent administration. That may or may not be an unfair charge. But when you go from Afghanistan to the home testing kits to baby formula, and then you throw in inflation and gas prices, you can see why the Democrats are facing a possible shellacking in November. All right, story number four. Jen Psaki's last day as press secretary is today. Yesterday, she was doing some cleanup for her successor as press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre. You know, as with anybody, it seems like anybody gets nominated to anything, you know, has a long history of tweets or old blogs or something where stuff comes out. And, you know, it's sort of part of the, I want to say game or ritual, because some of this is serious stuff. So Karine Jean-Pierre has said some things over the years that she obviously wouldn't want to repeat today. And Mediaite has a good piece on this and an interview with Psaki, which I'll get to in just a moment. So in 2016, Jean-Pierre wrote, "Stolen emails, stolen drones, stolen election. Welcome to the world of hashtag unprecedented Trump," spelled unprecedented. She tweeted that was a month after Hillary Clinton lost the election. And it was part of a quote tweet. Then in 2020, so this is not ancient history, talking about the governor of Georgia. Reminder, Brian Kemp stole the gubernatorial election from Georgians and Stacey Abrams. Abrams had alleged voter suppression. So here's what Jen Psaki has to say on the tweet about Governor Kemp. "We all agree the 2018 election in Georgia is settled. And we're also all concerned about voter suppression issues, including the president. Kemp won, and she sees that tweet as having oversimplified the problem." So she, in her capacity as the White House press secretary, is playing defense for the incoming White House press secretary, who is now the deputy and is a close friend of hers. As for the 2016 tweet, remember, you know, the Biden administration's position is that he won the election fair and square. That's also the position of the media, all the people who've investigated it, but not Donald Trump. And many Republicans believe that the election was, in fact, as the former president claims, rigged. So here's the incoming press secretary having said this in 2016. You know, as I just read, unprecedented Trump. So Jen Psaki tells Mediaite, "Jean-Pierre has affirmed that Donald Trump won in 2016, too. Like so many of us, Karine was concerned about the U.S. intelligence community's unanimous finding that Russia intervened to help Trump. But he won." Just 4 years later, she hastens to add, "Joe Biden won the most votes of anyone in American history. She's aligned with the president that people should admit who won regardless of preference." And then there's Karine Jean-Pierre in 2020 when she was on Joy Reid's program. That was when it was a weekend program. And she denounced Fox News as racist. Here's what Jen Psaki says. "This is a years-old clip of Karine referring to an opinion host, not a reporter, when she was not in government and not speaking on behalf of the president." And here's, you know, I have a passing interest in this. "As she has shown at the White House many times already, including in the briefing room, she will continue to follow the guidance of the president in engaging with a range of reporters from a broad range of outlets, including Fox, even when there are different points of view." So interesting that the White House chose to handle it this way. I guess a lot of the questions would have come up at Karine Jean-Pierre's first briefing. They may anyway. But as I say, in one of her last official acts, Jen Psaki trying to defuse the controversy that has arisen around her successor. Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this. And finally, number five. This is a bit of a scoop from Puck. I do not have it confirmed, but I will read it to you regardless. Puck is reporting, Tara Palmieri, that Judy Woodruff, who has had such a long and distinguished career, currently the anchor of PBS's NewsHour, will step down as anchor after the midterm elections. And it says that she's already carefully picked her successors, who are Amna Nawaz and Jeff Bennett. Judy Woodruff is 75 years old. She's been a member of the Washington Press Corps since 1976, when, as I recall, she was a reporter for NBC. And she went on to a very good career at CNN when I often work with her. I also work with her occasionally at the NewsHour. She is a class act. She is somebody who, you know, you can criticize this, that, or the other thing, but she is not flashy. She's about substance. She tries to get to the facts. She is just, I admire her very much. And then leaving CNN, she had been at PBS. She went to CNN. She was the anchor of Inside Politics when that program was sort of getting off the ground. And she could have stayed at CNN, but she chose to go back to PBS and become, join the NewsHour, which Jim Lehrer was in anchoring. He was 78 when he stepped down. She is 75. And, you know, again, Puck called PBS, and PBS would neither confirm nor deny that Judy Woodruff plans to make this move. So I think that is probably true. Again, it's completely unconfirmed. But, you know, I do think in a hyper-partisan era when so many people, and this is not just cable news, when so many people online, when so many people on Twitter, when so many people on all kinds of websites, you know, basically are playing the politics of anger, the politics of fear, the politics of outrage, often the politics of selective outrage. There are relatively few people who, you know, some of them, not exclusively, but some of them tend to be older, who came up in the world of journalism that I came up in, which is you try to be fair to all sides. And if you were an opinion person or a columnist, you would have strong views, but you wouldn't demonize the other side. There was a general, I mean, look, the politics were different then too. Joe Biden often talks about this. He talks about it too much, in my view, but he grew up at a time when you could even work with the, remember when he got in trouble for talking about how he enjoyed working with Strom Thurmond, even though Strom Thurmond had been a segregationist? You know, people were appalled by that. It was a different era. The Tip O'Neill era, or the even John Boehner. You know, you butt heads, you try to beat the other side, you try to kick the crap out of the other side, and then, you know, you go have a beer. You know, it wasn't as personally, there wasn't so much personal animosity as there is in politics today. And this predates Donald Trump. Donald Trump maybe caught that wave and capitalized on it, but he didn't create it. Look, I mean, the Republicans impeached Bill Clinton, and then the Democrats impeached Donald Trump twice. We can argue about the relative merits of those battles, all of which is a long-winded way of saying that when it comes to journalism, it's hard these days to have a career that spans many decades, where, you know, I know a lot of people think PBS is very liberal, and I'm sure I could find examples of that. But I wouldn't hammer Judy Woodruff over that. She's interviewed lots of presidents. I mean, she's just, the record is there. Am I influenced somewhat by the fact that I know her and have worked for her and like her very much? Sure. We all bring our judgments to bear. And I'm just saying, if she is, by the way, the story did say, I should hasten to point out, that she would continue at PBS in some undetermined role, maybe as an analyst or something, but not behind the anchor desk. And, you know, it's good we don't have to be carried out, right? When you reach the point where you realize it's time to call it quits. These are demanding jobs, and you give some of the younger folks a chance. I very much appreciate your time on this podcast. Another subtle reminder that we've got a pretty good media buzz coming up here. We're going to talk about baby formula, maybe. We'll talk about Biden's inflation speech. We'll talk about Elon Musk and Twitter, of course. Glenn Greenwald will be one of my guests. We'll talk about Supreme Court and abortion rights controversy. We will talk about the war. I've only got 60 minutes, but I've kind of made an art of trying to cram in as much. And yet these days I say, oh, if only I could get to this. So sometimes I deal with it on the podcast. Sometimes I deal with it in my online columns. And often I deal with it here on the podcast. Have a great weekend, folks. We're back here Monday with more BuzzBeater.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.